today on Post Carbon Radio, talking with Kuhan Pak, who is a journalist, media educator, and campaign director of the Asia-Pacific Program at the International Forum on Globalization. Kuhan is the author of an article that was just published on Common Dreams on November 4th, entitled Islanders Unite to Resist a New Pacific War. Welcome, Kuhan.
Hi, Karen. Great to be here.
Today we're going to talk about a wide range of subjects involving the Asia-Pacific region. We're going to discuss militarization of the region, environmental impacts of that militarization, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and the relationship between all those entities. So one suggestion to our listeners is, if you have a chance, you might want to pull up a map of the Asia-Pacific region. Kuhan, you started with this action because you're an environmentalist, and I understand you went to a conference in Okinawa. Who was there, and what was that conference about?
Well, basically, what's going on right now in the Pacific is the Pacific Pivot, which your listeners might have heard of. The Pacific Pivot is a massive affront militarily to this region. It's in response to a rising China. U.S. is a hegemon that is trying to do everything it can to maintain control of the Asia-Pacific region. And what that means, it means a lot of base building, it means a lot of military war practice in the ocean, and all this stuff impacts local island communities. So this conference was called Peace for the Sea Camp. They call it a camp because it's really a lot of people under 30, and they sort of did camp out in these different ryokans, which in Japan are like youth hostels. And they came together to talk about how this Pacific Pivot militarization is impacting their environment, their local communities, their democracies. They came from islands all over the region. They came from Taiwan, they came from the Ryukyu Islands, which is a chain of islands that stretches from the southernmost part of Japan all the way down to Taiwan. They came from South Korea. They came from the Ogasawara Islands, which is a second chain a little bit further east of the Ryukyus. Some people from the Mariana Islands were trying to get funding to come. They couldn't make it. It's a group called Our Islands Are Sacred, because all these islands, including the island where I live, Hawaii Island, and the Hawaiian archipelago, are being impacted tremendously by this Pacific Pivot, which actually is defined as the shifting of 60% of all Navy and Air Force resources from the Middle East to the Asia Pacific. And how that's taking place has been absolutely detrimental to the environment.
So the Pacific Pivot you mentioned in your article was announced in 2011, right? Mm-hmm. So it's well underway, is that correct?
It's well underway, and even though the announcement was as late as 2011, the U.S. has had a foothold very strongly entrenched in the Asia-Pacific region since World War II. So really, it's not so much a pivot as it is a ramping up. I mean, there have been over 400 bases in the Asia-Pacific for decades, U.S. bases. People are talking about how China is getting so militarily aggressive. Well, China did build these artificial islands on, I believe it was 9 reefs in the South China Sea, totaling 3 military bases. Well, if you include those 3 bases, and then they've got one in the Seychelles, clearly that is not at all in parity with the over 400 bases that we have in the region.
So one of the places we're talking about with these bases and these islands is the South China Sea. What is going on with the United States and China in the South China Sea?
Well, it's very interesting, and this is where you need to look at the map. Because if you look at the map right under Indochina, you will see that there is this body of water called the Strait of Malacca, right south of Singapore. And it's a little narrow channel. It's 50 miles only at its narrowest. And it is through this channel that all oil that comes from the Middle East, destined for China, South Korea, and Japan, which are 3 of the largest economies in the world, pass through this little strait. They go into the South China Sea. And so just yesterday in Hawaii, Secretary of Defense Ashton Carter was talking to the troops and saying, this is the artery of the world's economy. So imagine if all the oil that goes into Japan, South Korea, and China comes through here, whoever controls this strait controls the Asian economy, which in turn drives the world economy. And that is why it is so critically important for the U.S. to maintain control of this region.
I've heard people say that in terms of the geopolitics of oil, we tend to focus on the United States using war and militarism to gain access to the oil, but another military strategy is to deny access to your enemies. Is that part of what you think is going on?
Oh, absolutely. There's definitely a zero-sum game mentality involved in the way the U.S. is continuing to think about geopolitics, which is so wrong in a world with very finite resources. Okay, maybe in World War II you could think about it that way. World War I, wars previous, but right now we're facing the end of ecological sustainability, and it doesn't work that way anymore. We've got to think about cooperation. We've got to cooperatively ramp down our consumption, and we're doing exactly the opposite, and so is China. China doesn't approach it in such a zero-sum game strategy, but nonetheless, they're continuing to consume, continuing to expand ever since they decided to embrace state capitalism.
Well, and without getting too far down the road on China, we will get back to the environment in just a moment. I just want to ask, because it seems like China is our frenemy, right? On the one hand, a friend to American capitalism because American production is happening there, but on the other hand, a geopolitical hegemonic rival, as you said. Do you want to comment on that?
Well, I think you said it exactly the way it is, and this is the nature of a time where globalization has sort of inextricably linked enemies and friends, because there is so much cross-border commerce and at the same time simultaneous rivalry for resources. And it's a conundrum that we've never dealt with before. So to approach it the way this Pacific pivot is operating, where we want to control the region closest to them. I mean, can you imagine if China was putting missiles throughout the Caribbean and in Mexico and in Canada pointed to us, which is essentially what we're doing? I think it's the wrong approach in a time where both hegemons, or at least the U.S., are fighting for control of the world's last remaining resources in order to continually expand the profits of a handful of corporate oligarchs.
So let's get back to the geography and the military, and then again, we will get to the environmental impacts. But in your article, you talk about very specific named islands and island chains on which the military base building is happening, mostly from the American side, as you said, but also from the Chinese side. Do you want to talk a little bit about where it's happening and what's being built on those islands?
Well, one of the main thrusts of the Pacific pivot is to encircle China with missiles. So they've already coerced or convinced South Korea to build a base, a missile-carrying base, Aegis missile-equipped Navy base in Jeju Island, which is a beautiful island on which there's a World Heritage Site, UNESCO World Heritage Site. Right adjacent to that was where they built this Navy base. And the village where they built it, I'd visited it several times, was one of the most remarkable sustainable communities I'd ever seen. It had the cleanest water I'd ever seen. In fact, some people from Europe came down and tested it. It tested more pure and full of minerals than Evian water. Those springs have been cemented over in order to build the base on top. On the coastline, there were like 50 different species of shellfish and 500 different species of seaweeds, and it was this coastline that fed this village. They never had to go shopping for food. That's been covered up, and now those people will have to find jobs on the base or opening up bars or restaurants or businesses that would serve the military community. So the base got built this year after 8 years of the most ferocious and tearful protests. And the first Aegis missile destroyer came to port while we were at the conference in Okinawa, and people were crying, and it was really awful. But on the other hand, they are not quitting. They are undaunted, and it was with renewed strength that we carried on with the conference. Okay, so the Pacific Pivot is about encircling China with bases. That was one of the base. Missile bases.
Can I just ask, Aegis missiles, are those nuclear missiles?
They are meant to intercept missiles going through. Aegis was a shield that one of the Greek characters carried. It was defensive. So it's billed as a defensive missile. However, the design of it is such that it can be offensive or defensive. It can knock out satellites. And you can put a nuclear warhead on it. They make sure that these are very versatile. But it's billed as defensive, not aggressive. And they're completely aggressive, especially when you're encircling another continent or country with them. And so you've got that, and you've got Aegis in Okinawa as well.
So we're moving now from South Korea to Japan.
Right. So if you're looking at your map, you'll see South Korea is, well, Jeju Island is 300 miles from Beijing. And then you come over to the east a bit and you see the Japanese islands, the main islands. And you come down about 500 miles from there and you've got Okinawa, which is smack dab in the middle of the Ryukyu Archipelago. The Ryukyu Archipelago is a string of exquisite undeveloped islands stretching from the bottom of Japan all the way down to Taiwan, about 900 miles. In the middle is Okinawa, which is the only developed one, and which is covered with U.S. bases, which is why a lot of news has been coming out recently on the protests against building yet another base. I believe there are 37 U.S. bases there now on an island that is a little smaller than Kauai. So the people are living chock-a-block together with this base right in the middle, taking up all this space, and there's Osprey helicopters going overhead. They're crashing in the middle of the cities. One crashed into a university a few years back. There's terrible rapes, which is what really set off. In 1995, there was a gang rape of a 14-year-old girl, and it set off this huge blowback to any kind of U.S. Base building whatsoever. Now, it was also because of that that the U.S. started another strategy, and that was to build what I call it, the outsourcing base building, where they get a client state like South Korea to build the Jeju base, but make it South Korean in name only. However, it still fulfills the mission of the Pentagon, which is to encircle China with these missile bases. They're doing the same now with Japan. And that's what's going on now with these other islands in the Ryukyu Peninsula. One north of Okinawa, three south of Okinawa. And I just visited them because when I was at the conference in Okinawa was where I first heard of it.
And when was that conference?
That was in September. That was a couple months ago. This is not reported anywhere. What is going on now? And what that is four more bases are being built that flank China. China has said they consider this a very provocative move. The islanders who live on these islands where the bases are being built recognize that they are now the most likely first strike targets for if any war in the Pacific breaks out. They are very near the South China Sea. They're very near the disputed Senkaku Islands, which is to the north of the South China Sea just a bit. And that's what it is geopolitically in terms of safety, in terms of world peace. It's a disaster. And in terms of environment, it couldn't be worse. And I'll tell you why. Amami Oshima is one of the islands I visited. After hearing about this in Okinawa, I thought, I'm going to go to these other islands and see what's going on.
And these are all Japanese islands
you're
talking about now.
These are all Japanese islands. They're building Japanese bases. That way they won't have to deal with any kind of environmental responsibility, or the U.S. won't have to. It'll all be on Japan. The cost of building will be on Japan. They won't have to worry about Japanese people protesting U.S. bases like in Okinawa because they'll be Japanese bases. There's much less respect for human rights in Japan. They will throw people in jail for protesting. In fact, there's a lawsuit on one of these islands. Okay, I'll tell you the names of the islands. Amami Oshima to the north of Okinawa, Miyakojima, Ishigaki, and Yonaguni to the south of the islands. On Miyakojima, there's already a lawsuit that's been filed against the Japanese government for blacklisting employment of anyone who has spoken out against these bases. And it's really awful because nobody was giving any warning whatsoever. All of a sudden, the bulldozers just came and started dredging, and nobody knew. There was one meeting in Amami Oshima. An official came out for 15 minutes. He said there will be troops that will be living on your island. He never mentioned that there would be a missile base. He never mentioned that there would be a live fire range where bullets of depleted uranium would be detonated, and that just spreads radioactive material throughout the island. He never mentioned that there would be a radar station. And it was like this on all the islands. But the thing about Amami Oshima that, to me, is so heartbreaking is just like the sheer biodiversity of this place. I've never been to a place that was so teeming with life. And the reason, ironically, is because the island's forests contain two extremely venomous snakes that has kept people out of the forest. In fact, every tourist that comes there, including myself, as soon as you land, they say, don't go in the brush, don't go in the forest, don't go in the jungle. You'll get bit by a snake and you'll die immediately. So as a result, I mean, it's kind of like the DMZ between North and South Korea. It's just teeming with creatures that don't exist anywhere else. There are six endemic birds that are found only on that island. There are 300 species of birds total. There are a handful of species of frogs found only on that island. There are pufferfish that are amazing because it's the only place where the pufferfish actually make these sand mandalas underneath the surface of the ocean. People didn't know what they were for decades. They were calling them the mysterious crop circles of Amami Oshima.
That's what it sounds like.
Yeah, and people thought they were UFOs. They didn't know what it was. And then some diver 2 years ago saw this little tiny pufferfish, and they're about 3 meters in diameter, and he's there going back and forth like a spirograph game that we used to have when we were kids.
I remember.
Making these little patterns and designs and then carrying over shells and pieces of coral and decorating it. And it turns out it was some sort of elaborate mating technique.
Like the bowerbird has competition in the sea.
Exactly. It's so bird-like. Anyway, there are amazing, wondrous species that very few people know anything about. In fact, this was just discovered 2 years ago. Now, as you can imagine, if you're going to build a missile range and if you're going to clear land and put a firing range to do live warfare games, all of this will go. And I've seen this go in the Mariana Islands. I've seen this go in Guam. They are now proposing this for Pagan Island.
Where's that?
Pagan Island. Okay, we're getting off track here. Now we're going to go to what the Chinese call the second island chain. Okay, strategically thinking, the Chinese use this technique that actually was first conceived of right after World War II by John Foster Dulles, and it was the first island chain, second island chain, third island chain strategy of warfare, and that is, they're sort of the lines of fire. So the first island chain would start up at the Sakhalin Islands, which is right north of Japan, come down through Japan, and then go through the Ryukyus down to Taiwan.
So that's kind of a north-south transect.
Yes, these are north-south, and it's all about like gaining ground. Like that, these are where the incremental moves are between the U.S. and China.
So it's an east-west battle fought across a north-south line. Is that right?
Perfect. Okay. Very well said. Okay, the second island chain that people are going through, that the two hegemons are striving to maintain a foothold in, would be through the Marianas. So that would be starting from the Ogasawara Islands, which come off Japan also, and then they come down through the Mariana Islands, which is just to the east of the Philippines, and then they come down through, if I'm not mistaken, New Guinea.
For listeners, I want you to know that Kuhan is doing this all from memory. We did not have a map in our interview.
Right. Well, you know, this is what I do, you know.
Yeah.
And then finally, the third island chain is Hawaii. Okay?
Home. Your home.
My home. And it's quite interesting because as far back as the 1890s, Theodore Roosevelt and a military strategist by the name of Alfred Thayer Mann were discussing the necessity of taking Hawaii in order to continue manifest destiny into and throughout Asia. And so, in fact, there's a famous quote where Theodore Roosevelt said, "It will not be toward Europe and the Atlantic that America gains its wealth, but it will be looking westward through the Pacific toward Asia." And there's a very famous letter that Top Secret, where Roosevelt's talking to Mann, and he starts out by saying, "I trust this will be kept confidential, but I know that we think really alike, and it is imperative that we take Hawaii, and if I could do it tomorrow, I would, because that's how America will expand." So anyway, getting back to the Pacific pivot, these four islands just south of Japan are continuing that encircling of China with missiles, and it's so terribly destructive to the nature there. These are, in fact, Amami Oshima is now being nominated to be a UNESCO World Heritage Site.
Just remind people what UNESCO is.
UNESCO is sort of like the designation that the United Nations puts out for really for special places of natural or cultural heritage. And so if you've got this endorsement, it can be used as a way to preserve the area. A lot of times it's used as a way to commodify it, which is unfortunate. But in any case, it certainly is a stamp of approval to show that you're one of the special biodiversity hotspots in the planet. And it really is. In fact, there's this small-eared black rabbit, the Amami rabbit, that's found only there, of course. And they call it a living fossil because its DNA matches so closely, identical to fossils that they have found. It's one of the few mammals that has that kind of ancient connection. Now, if you go all the way south to Yonaguni Island, where I also visited, I'm a horse fan, and they have endemic ponies that are found only there. The Yonaguni pony, and they trot around in herds freely. There's no fences on this 11 square mile island, so they'll go into like the little Japanese village. There are no hotels or restaurants. It's not a commercial island at all. It's strictly people living sustainably. And these little ponies, you can walk up to them and pet them, but they're wild, and they'll just trot along, and then they trot into the pastures, and they trot on the sidewalks, and there's a lot of Yonaguni is so sustainable that they don't even have capitalist enterprise like restaurants or hotels. It's just people living as farmers, livestock. They raise livestock and fishermen. And then there's these wild ponies that are endemic to Yonaguni, trotting along on this fenceless island through into the pastures, onto the sidewalks, where you'll see a lot of horse manure, and nobody thinks anything of it. It's sort of like how I imagine it is with the cattle in Delhi. I'm not sure, but people really respect them, and they're wild and they're endemic, and it's charming. And I was just heartbroken to hear that their main watering hole has now been covered over with a lot of the land that's been moved from the bulldozers, because they've taken over their watering hole, and it's going to be the site of a big radar station that's going to spy on China.
I want to pause here for a moment because I'm pleased that we're getting into the environment, but I want to make sure that we cover another point of military strategy, because we talked about the Aegis missiles, and now we're talking about radar, and you said that Aegis missiles are purportedly defensive, but I know from people who work on nuclear weapons that all the so-called defensive shields are really part of the first strike strategy, that if you have a good shield up, the notion is then that you can make the first nuclear strike because you're protected against, right? Against
the
retaliation.
Totally right.
And so you were talking about the fact that the islanders where these bases are being placed now think they're going to be the target, because that becomes the game, right?
Right.
Is taking out the radar and taking out the defensive. I just wanted to add that into our
I think it's brilliant, and thank you so much, Karin, for adding that in. Yeah, it's I just am heartbroken over what these poor people have to go through, simply because geography is destiny.
But that reminds me of a quote from your article where you said, the youth who pulled together this peace camp, what was it called again, the camp?
Peace for the Sea.
Peace for the Sea, that they said they're creating a new geography. Do you want to talk a little bit about the resistance? Because as I looked a little bit more into this issue, the articles that I found online, I learned from you that a lot of the youth were leading the resistance and that that was surprising because we'd expect people who remembered World War II, you know, the really old people, to know how bad war is, particularly in Japan, when Japan was an aggressive country and was, you know, had this peace constitution. But what I also see in some of these other articles is a lot of women. What was your experience of who's doing the resistance against the U.S. base building and the environmental destruction in the Asia-Pacific region?
Well, I take for granted in Asia that I'm going to be working predominantly with women, and I haven't really thought about the gender difference between Western demilitarization movements and Asian ones. But yeah, that is a phenomenon. I haven't really analyzed it. I think it might have something to do with the fact that because it is in living memory, the horrors of Hiroshima and war, or just simply the burning down of Tokyo, and also the disillusionment of realizing that everything you believed in that the emperor was saying was complete bunk. I think that that firsthand experience really, I've talked to Japanese women, and they really see patriarchy as being the root of the problems. And I think they feel, and not only in Japan, but also in Korea, which both of which are highly patriarchal countries. And I think that the men and the women really feel that it is up to the women to lead this, that they have a kind of knowledge that is special and that they should be the leaders.
You're listening to Post Carbon Radio. Today we're talking with Kuhan Pak of the International Forum on Globalization. She is the author of the recent article, Islanders Unite to Resist a New Pacific War. So we've talked a bit about Jeju and then some of the Japanese islands. Do you want to talk now about some of the treaties that are going on and the change in the Japanese constitution and Japan's military posture?
Oh, interesting. Well, you know, anyone who has studied post-World War II history, especially regarding the Pacific War, the war in the Pacific, knows that, or even if you've wondered why are Japanese cars so excellent in comparison to American cars, well, the reason is because after World War II, General MacArthur got together some of Japan's intelligentsia to put together what they thought would be the best way to ensure peace in the future for their country. And this is what the Japanese people wanted. Now, it has MacArthur's name on it, but it really was an indigenous document.
You're talking about the Constitution.
I'm talking about the peace constitution. And the result of that was Walkmans, Hondas. Japan came out of the ashes of World War II and emerged as really the pinnacle of electronic and engineering accomplishments, right? Well, that's because they put all that effort that had gone into making war machines into making entertainment machines, right? And non-aggressive technology. Well, all that has been undone as of this year. This was a result of a lot of pressure from the Pentagon, but also in collusion with a president, a prime minister who's now in office, Shinzo Abe, whose grandfather was a war hawk, didn't want to see the empire fall, and he sort of like creating a renaissance of that kind of Japanese military aggression. He wants that. So the U.S. and Japan came together during talks to, believe it or not, during TPP talks to sort of iron out difficulties. And funnily enough, the result is they came to some sort of backroom deal compromise where Japan acceded to a lot of the demands of the U.S. in exchange for the U.S. to agree to dismantle the peace constitution.
When did this start? How long has this been playing out for, taking place?
Well, Japan joined the TPP in 2013, and there was an absolute gridlock. In fact, people thought they were not going to be able to come to agreement at all with the U.S. over tariffs on cars and agriculture. And as recently as April of this year, 2015, they thought that there would be absolutely no budging on that.
Because Japan was protecting its industries, its agriculture and its cars with import tariffs.
Absolutely. Okay. Thank you. Strangely enough, it was analysts say that the reason why there was suddenly this meeting between the defense ministers of Japan and the U.S. and the Secretary of State, so that would be Ashton Carter and John Kerry, met with the counterparts in Japan at the same time that Shinzo Abe came and met in Washington, D.C. with Barack Obama. And it was after that secret defense meeting that suddenly, the very next day, Barack Obama and Shinzo Abe came out in a press conference in the Rose Garden talking about how they were committed to a swift and expedient conclusion to the TPP, and that Shinzo Abe, the day after that, promised Congress that he would do everything he could to push through legislation that would dismantle the Constitution, as if he had some sort of unilateral control over democratic process.
But so spell it out for us. What do you think the backroom deal was?
Well, I haven't read the new TPP information that's come out, so I'm curious to see how that transpired with Japan. I think it was on beef. I think they didn't want to import, or it was rice. I don't remember.
I think in your article you mentioned both.
Did I?
Yeah,
I'd like to compare, but whatever shift was made, that was the trigger.
So the deal was, right, that Japan said they were going to lower their tariffs on rice and beef in exchange for...
in exchange for the U.S. allowing them to dismantle their peace constitution, which the U.S. wanted anyway, because now they can outsource the military force to Japan. For example, with the new constitution, they are now able to surveil overseas, whereas before they were not allowed to spy on other countries. Now they can do that. And because of that, they're able to move forward with building the radar station in Yonaguni to spy on China.
So basically what's changed since World War II is that Japan was an aggressive imperialist nation then, but it was our enemy. But now we're allowing Japan to arm up and be an aggressive military nation, but they're our ally. Is that correct?
Right. It's like hiring a thug to be on your side, unfortunately. And I'm just heartbroken about it, because this is the party that the U.S. put into power. They took war criminals out of prison after World War II once they sensed that Russia would be a threat and the Cold War began. So they took these Japanese war criminals out and said, listen, you can be on our side, be in power. That's the LDP party. That's the party that's still in office. That's Shinzo Abe's party.
Liberal Democratic Party.
Right. It's neither liberal or democratic, and it's no party. So they put them in office. They've been in office continually except for a guy named Yukio Hatoyama, who was elected by a landslide in 2008. And the U.S. did everything they could to mess him up, and he ended up having to resign. I don't know the details of it, but it's a tragedy, because they're not allowing democracy to take place. And when Shinzo Abe dismantled his peace constitution, his ratings plummeted to below 40%. When I was there, no matter where you went in the country, you saw posters of him dressed up like Hitler. You saw a lot of posters, bumper stickers, T-shirts, fans. People are just really crushed that their voices aren't being heard. Their environments are being destroyed, and there's no democracy, because Japan is doing the U.S. bidding, and they know it. They know exactly what's going on. And so I feel like my job is to come and expose what we're doing over there to these people, and so that we can support them, because it's not going to be American people that change this. It's going to have to be them, and they need our support.
How did the Fukushima meltdown affect the election of Shinzo Abe as Prime Minister of Japan? How did he get elected? Why is this guy in power if he's so unpopular?
You know, I talked to Eileen Smith, who is probably the preeminent expert on Fukushima, and she's there working for those people 24/7, making sure that the kids can find a place to go outside to play, if it means shipping them to Hawaii for 2 weeks or whatever. And she said the economy's been tanking so bad, and he really ran on an economics platform. He didn't mention any of this stuff. So everybody's a little bit, they feel like they've been blindsided by what's happened, to be honest, and they're very upset about it.
Because the election was before this TPP deal came up.
Oh, right? Yeah, he was the one that joined TPP shortly after he was elected, yeah.
So you mentioned in your article that there are some countries missing in Asia in the TPP, some of the big players, and that it's some of the small economy nations that are involved. Why is that?
Oh, that's a great question, Karin. Yeah, it's true. You know, Indonesia is the fourth largest economy in Asia. India, huge economy. China, of course, right? Why are they not in the Trans-Pacific Partnership? Well, I think the exclusion of China makes it really obvious that this is about writing rules for trade that will exclude China so that the U.S. rules get made. In fact, Barack Obama said recently, if we don't write the rules in that region, China will, so we better get on it. Okay, so if you look at who are the Asian countries involved in TPP, you've got Brunei, Malaysia, Singapore, and Vietnam. These are countries with tiny economies. These countries don't account for like this big, grandiose Trans-Pacific Partnership. They don't justify it. Okay, you've got Japan, but Japan only joined recently. Why do we have these countries? Well, these countries also happen to be near the choke point. I mentioned earlier the Malacca Straits and the South China Sea. So if we can provide them the kind of American muscle they need in their... All these countries are in maritime territorial disputes with China. So if we can protect their sea lanes, and in exchange, will they protect our sea lanes and they're part of the TPP, then we've got those sea lanes secured. And that's why we have enlisted and recruited those countries.
And just to be really clear, when we're talking about the United States securing the sea lanes, it's for what or against what?
It's for trade rules that are determined and made by the U.S. in the same way that the Trans-Pacific Partnership are a set of rules that benefit American corporations. It would be a physical, geographic implementation of those trade rules. We're talking about ships. We're talking about $700 million warships patrolling to secure that our container ships get through. If we're having a conflict with China, we don't want China to be in control of those sea lanes. We want to be in control of the movement of trade, because what good is the TPP trade agreement if we don't have control of the Pacific trade routes?
To enforce it.
To enforce it, right. So already Singapore has ported 4 littoral combat ships, which are these huge, mean battleships. And we've got Marines stationed in Australia. But I want to mention the other Asian nations in TPP, Asia-Pacific nations, besides those 4 countries around the choke point, are Japan and Australia and New Zealand. The Pentagon calls Japan the North Anchor of the region, to keep the U.S. interests anchored, and they call Australia and New Zealand the South Anchor. So if you look at the TPP from a Pentagon, from a military strategy point of view, it makes perfect sense. You've got the North and South Anchors, strong military economies and strong allies, and then you've got the countries that are right around the choke point that are part of TPP, that will help enforce, that will do the war games, the military practice, so that if there's a problem, they will enforce our rules. So from a military point of view, it makes perfect sense, TPP. But from a trade point of view, it's kind of shaky. Why is China not there? Why is Indonesia not there? Why is India not there? Why are these dinky little economies there? Well, that's why.
Especially because India is a big U.S. ally now.
Huge. And I'm not sure why they're not, but Another really disturbing development is the bilateral agreement that Ashton Carter made this year with India, and that is it's a 10-year contract to launch India's defense industry. They will start manufacturing aircraft carriers and jet fighter engines for us, which really I find to be heartbreaking that the nation from which Gandhi hails is going to be getting itself entrenched in an industry and an economy that is so violent and destructive to the planet and to everyone. 10-year contract.
What strikes me about that, it reminds me of Gulf War I and that the United States spent months moving materiel into the Gulf region in order to prosecute the war. But if the materiel is being produced on the Asian continent, then it's already closer to its destination, right? So we've started talking about the TPP, but in your article you also mention a bilateral treaty between the United States and Japan around the Constitution. Is that correct? Or what was this resuscitated treaty that you mentioned?
Oh, that's interesting. Right. Well, the U.S. has terrible bilateral treaties with most Asian countries, or at least half of them. Security of Forces Agreement, or the U.S., in this case, the U.S.-Japan Security Alliance. These were all made after World War II, and they sort of lay out the game plan of what is called mutual defense, but really it's client-state relationships where they do U.S. bidding. And in this case, it spells out exactly what the U.S. expects Japan to do now that there is all this conflict going on in the South China Sea. And what it articulates is stuff that relates to keeping sea lanes clear, such as attacking a vessel that's not authorized to be coming through the South China Sea or the Malaccan Straits, sweeping for mines, laying mines, a lot of aggressive offensive activity that is great for the U.S. because we don't have to do it. We don't have to pay for it. And then we've got someone there policing the area according to our will. And that is what the new U.S.-Japan Security Treaty does. It takes, the old one was in place, and it really takes advantage of the new legislation that was pushed through by Shinzo Abe to dismantle the peace constitution and let them be aggressive for the U.S.
What's Japan getting out of this? It seems like Japan's going to have to pay for all this militarization unless there's some kind of, you know, unless money's getting kicked back somehow. What is Japan getting in terms of their political economy? What are they getting out of this deal?
Believe it or not, what Japan is going for is a future, to revive its future greatness, imperial greatness. And this is the through line in Shinzo Abe's career, also in his grandfather's. He's carrying out his grandfather's will. He'll probably not get reelected. His popularity is at an all-time low, but he has great filial loyalty to his grandfather, who was also prime minister and who was also had to resign because he was pushing through more aggressive legislation as well. But it was so soon after the war that they didn't let it fly, and he had to leave in shame. So he's sort of like making good on that legacy.
Kind of like the George Bush thing for his father.
Exactly. But much more, I think, dangerous for the region and for the world. Well,
because greatness implies conquest of territory, or does it not?
Oh, absolutely. But the difference between this particular Japanese strain of thought, because most of Japanese people do not want to go in this direction whatsoever. They cherish the peace constitution. They love it. But there's this minority who really, they will not apologize for the comfort women. Mm-hmm. They will not apologize.
Or sex slaves, just in case people don't know.
Right, for the women that were taken as slaves from Korea, from the Philippines, from Burma, from everywhere where the Japanese were. China. To this day, there's friction between China and China, Korea, and all the Asian countries and Japan, because unlike Germany, which sort of dealt with their angst through media, film, books and consciousness raising groups, it has not been in the Asian or in the Japanese culture. This is a Japanese...
You're talking about the Germans dealing with a legacy of their fascist history.
Exactly, exactly. And the Italians. Mm-hmm. You know, it's been really... there's been a clampdown, and I think it has to do with the fact that the U.S. put the LDP in power, so they erased history in textbooks whenever they could. It was always considered déclassé to talk about that stuff. To talk about the legacy, and unpatriotic. So because it's never been dealt with, that's a big difference, I think.
And that's part of, reminds me of Naomi Wolf's book, The End of America, because she talks about the blueprint for fascism, and one of the steps in the blueprint is to recast dissent as treason. The question of it being anti-patriotic.
Anyway, oh, God, yes. It's absolutely true. Yeah, it's absolutely true.
Any more comments you want to make about this Japan bilateral treaty or the other treaties that you mentioned in your article?
Well, yeah, what I'd like to talk about, I'd like to talk about the environment.
Yeah.
Because I got into this as an environmentalist. As a result, I've become a quasi-expert in Asia-Pacific geopolitics. But I'll tell you, I grew up part of my life in Guam and had a lot of access to the Micronesian islands, the Federated States of Micronesia, Yap, Palau. And I'll tell you, it's one of the most spectacular and dreamy, exquisite places on the planet because these are islands, you know, every place is so uniquely its own thing. For example, there's a freshwater lake in Palau you might know about where it's the only place where they have freshwater jellyfish. They're not venomous. They're pink. They're like pink pastel colored and you go swimming and they just massage you all over like these little velvety massagers. And I hear now that so many tourists are going that they're starting to die just because of sunscreen and whatnot. But this is the kind of wondrous detail that riddles these islands. And I really want to do everything I can to protect them. And it's really difficult because people are so willing to protect the places that they've heard of, like mm-hmm. Hawaii, where I live. But because everyone's heard of Hawaii, it doesn't have a fraction of the biodiversity of these places that nobody cares about protecting. So that's sort of where I see my role. But I want to talk about not only the bilateral agreement between the U.S. and Japan, but Ashton Carter, our defense secretary, went on a barnstorming tour, well, three of them this year. And even now, he might have just gotten back, but he just returned from Asia. And he's going and he's making deals. He's making deals that are so, so detrimental to the environment because what they are is they're deals to do joint naval exercises. Now, joint naval exercises are where you get a load of tanks together, amphibious tanks, to go up reefs. You get a load of airplanes on aircraft carriers. You start bombing the ocean. You get nuclear-powered submarines. You're sending detonations and missiles through the ocean. You're dropping bombs. And you're using sonar testing. Okay, so this is rampant. This is not only rampant with the U.S. doing it themselves, but this is going to be increasingly rampant because in our effort to secure these oceans, we're making deals to do joint military naval exercises with a slew of countries. And I'll tell you which countries they are. This is a lot. We've got the Philippines and the U.S. together. 12,000 troops in June every year. They're doing amphibious exercises. They're doing all of these detonations. The U.S. in Singapore in July. The U.S. with Indonesia in August. The U.S. with South Korea in August. India, Japan, and the U.S. in the Bay of Bengal. That just finished. And bilateral joint exercises with the following countries from July through November every year. Bangladesh, Brunei, Cambodia, Indonesia, Malaysia, Thailand, Timor-Leste, and Vietnam. Okay, but the most destructive and biggest one is one called Talisman Saber. And that is held, it's going to be held every year. It was held for the first year this year. And that was over 33,000 soldiers, 21 ships, Osprey helicopters, Cobra helicopters, jet fighters, 3 submarines, amphibious assault ships, and over 200 aircraft. And we're talking about officers and troops from the U.S., Australia, New Zealand, and Japan on, actually it's to take place every 2 years, on the north coast, completely untouched, undeveloped, pristine coast of Australia. It's called Shoalwater Bay. They always take the most beautiful places. They say it's because there's no development there, and probably that's right, but there's a lot of nature there. There's a lot of species there. And so think about all those countries that I've just named. Now, for the first time this year, they've begun shooting off all of these bombs, missiles, detonations. Also imagine how many arms are going to be sold from this. Lockheed Martin is going to make a killing. Samsung, a Korean company. Mitsubishi, now, because of this dismantled peace constitution, they can now manufacture and export with impunity offensive military weaponry. In fact, Mitsubishi, who, by the way, if you don't know, designed the Zero planes that came and bombed Pearl Harbor, they are now going to be, they have started a prototype for an amphibious tank. The generals in the Pentagon have praised it and have put in an order because it is so superior to American amphibious tanks because of the speed and traction that it has on reefs. Now imagine what that's going to do with all of the coastlines of these Asian, beautiful Asian coastlines and islands with all of these countries practicing every year.
No, you know, I'm a diver and I was just in Kauai, and I know as a diver, you're not even supposed to let the little rubber tip of your fin touch the reef because it's so delicate. So you told me in a previous conversation about amphibious aircraft carriers.
Oh my God. John Lattman, a journalist friend of mine who lives in Kauai, sent me a link. I mean, that's like the Transamerica building just crunching up on reefs. And with all of these arms, even if there's no war going on, they're practicing all the time. So for all of the species and creatures of the ocean and the coastline, it's like war all the time. And this is why I'm very distressed about it. Another thing, I don't know if you've ever heard of RIMPAC. I haven't even mentioned RIMPAC, but RIMPAC stands for Rim of the Pacific. And every 2 years, 23 nations come together to have a sort of World Cup of military exercises, and they're off the coast of Hawaii, and they sink 2 aircraft carriers. There's a lot of sonar, there's a lot of bombs, it's everything I mentioned before, but 100-fold. And this goes on for maybe as long as a month. The destruction to the marine environment is, it's unspeakable. So that's every 2 years. And now, this year, there was a meeting of the heads of the amphibious departments for 23 militaries across the world. They met in Honolulu this year, and they are going to now make an amphibious vehicles only RIMPAC every so often. And so, of course, if you're Mitsubishi, you're going to make a killing in profits, because that's one of the reasons they came out with a specifically amphibious tank. They foresee there's going to be a war, or at least practice, in the South China Sea, and they're cashing in on it. They're not making any kind of land vehicle. They're making one specifically where they see the action's going to be, and that's precisely why the Pentagon has decided, hey, let's do a RIMPAC for amphibious vehicles only. The actions in the South China Sea, in Southeast Asia, Asia, all those coastlines. For marine biologists and for people who care about the ocean, it's Armageddon. And one of the reasons it's been islands who've come together is because islanders really have an understanding of the ocean and really see themselves as caretakers of the ocean. And that's why these young people who came together all have been from islands rather than continents.
And how did they organize? Who brought them together? How did this happen?
Oh, gosh. You know, it happened because of the defeat of the Jeju base, their ability to stop the Jeju base. And like I said, those kids were undaunted. And they saw how Jeju plays in the bigger scheme of the Pentagon's chess game, and they realized that they've got to help other islands. Maybe if by helping other islands, we're all helping our ocean and helping our planet. And that's how I got involved, you know, because going to Jeju Island was so... I'm not a spiritual person at all, but being there, I felt like I was living in the palm of God every waking instant, because they are the most peace-loving and direct action and fierce people I've ever met. They would block the concrete mixers and the construction trucks going into the base twice a day by having a Catholic mass in the morning and a Protestant service in the afternoon every day, and then first thing in the morning, 100 bows by the Buddhists. So you were always aware of God. You were in the midst of godliness, always, always. And that's what kept everyone strong. And it was that is the spirit with which this group is progressing internationally to the other Asian nations like Japan and like Taiwan. And I might add, it's so ironic because in 2010, I was on Guam and I was attending a luncheon given by the Pentagon for the business community to explain how this was going to bring so much business. But what was so interesting is there was an official with the Pentagon. He was second in command for the Asia Pacific, very high level. And he started off his speech by saying that unlike European countries, the Asian countries are never going to be able to get along with one another, which is why the Pentagon in the U.S. needs to be there as peacekeepers. So this... you know, that got me going. And of course, I just started sounding off at once because it has been the U.S. presence that has created so much strife. If you look at the people, just last week, 70 and 80 year old people, protesters in Okinawa who don't want another base, were being violently hauled off, hit on the head by the Japanese police because they were blocking the construction of a new base, a new U.S. base at Henoko Bay, which is one of the last untouched beautiful base on the tropical island of Okinawa. Plus, you've got Taiwan and China. The U.S. will do everything it can to keep Taiwan as an ally. But it was so interesting because there were Taiwanese students there and they were saying, you know, we are in a really weird position because like half of the kids in Taiwan, one parent is from mainland China, the other parent is from Taiwan. So we don't buy the old narrative anymore, and we need to come together and cooperate. In the meantime, there's this archaic security treaty. You know, I was talking about how the U.S. has bilateral treaties with all the nations. So the one with Taiwan requires Taiwan to purchase hundreds of millions of dollars of arms every year from the U.S. Now, how is that going to promote peace? I know how it's going to promote profits for Lockheed Martin and Raytheon and General Dynamics, but yeah, those kids are amazing and they want peace, unlike what that Pentagon official said. And that's how the movement began. It's sort of like that Greek myth about the Hydra where you chop off one head and more grow. You know, it's really what's gone on. The U.S. built the base at Jeju, and what's happened is that Jeju movement went trans-Asia. It just exploded. And the more bases that get built, the more resistance we're going to see.
And this is a very recent phenomenon, right? This is just in the last few years that this explosion of the movement has happened from Jeju?
It's last year It started. And it really exploded this year because of the finality of the base being built, because the first destroyer came into port this year, 2 months ago. That was a huge spiritual blow to the people, but they gathered themselves up and they're determined to have the next peace camp in Taiwan next year.
So back here on the ground in California where we are, as we move to wrap up, you have succeeded in drawing together three major aspects: the trade agreements and other bilateral agreements, the militarization of Asia at the behest of and with the assistance of the United States, and the environmental impacts.
Okay, if this were about American bases overseas, the American people could have some say. But because it's outsourced to other countries. It's sort of like, you know, like outsourcing torture. Because really, like I say, it's going to be them who stop it. We have to support them in any way we can. And how can we empower them? What I've seen happen, like, for example, when the mafia had a stranglehold in Sicily, I saw how once the euro got involved, the power shifted because it became the European Union that controlled currency. So there needs to be...
If listeners want to make contact both to stay informed but also to figure out how to take action, can people contact you and how would they do that?
I would love to hear from people. If this grabs you, if you love the oceans, if you want to help sort of slow down or reverse this horrible process. I mean, also remember, the U.S. military is the number one consumer of fossil fuels and the number one spewer of greenhouse gases. I mean, if we can knock this out, it would be wonderful. So please send me an email. My email address is kohanpak@gmail.com. My name is spelled K-O-O-H-A-N, as in Nancy, P as in Paul, A-I-K, @gmail.com. Please write to me and let's put our heads together.
And the International Forum on Globalization, the website is?
Is ifg.org. And, you know, I've got a project I'd like to work on, and that is, I spoke with the young activists in Asia, and we'd like to get together a peace boat and do a flotilla that goes from Jeju Island down the Ryukyus to Taiwan, and possibly a picnic on the disputed Senkaku Islands, just in the spirit of peace. And that would sort of get movement, circulation of ideas going through these islands that often feel very isolated unto themselves, and let them know they've got support from the outside and they can support each other. And also at IFG, we're interested in doing a teach-in to raise awareness for people here in the United States as to what's going on. So write me an email. Hope to hear from you.
Well, on Post Carbon Radio, we've been talking with Kohanpak, a journalist, media educator, and campaign director of the Asia-Pacific Program at the International Forum on Globalization. She is the author of the recent article you can find on Common Dreams entitled Islanders Unite to Resist a New Pacific War. Kohan, thank you for being on Post Carbon Radio.
Thanks for having me, Karin.